the Mason-Dixon. This is the Week in Review at the Abbeville Institute. Here is your host, Brian McClanahan.
Welcome back to the Week in Review at the Abbeville Institute. This is your host, Brian McClanahan, and this is episode 137, covering the week of September 3rd through September 7th, 2018. Glad to have you back on the program. Very glad to be here. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Abbeville Institute, like our Facebook page at Abbeville Institute, and subscribe to our YouTube page at Abbeville Institute. You can find all those things at the top of our page at abbevilleinstitute.org. Go on there, and you can also give us an email address, and we'll give you a free ebook, and you get our daily dose of Dixie Monday through Friday, and our weekly email on Saturday or Sunday. Also, download our app. You can go to your favorite web application store, whether it's iTunes, Google Play, doesn't matter. You can go out and get the Abbeville Institute app, and then, of course, you can have the Abbeville Institute on the go, so go do that as well. Also, if you go to our webpage, abbevilleinstitute.org, you've got at the top of the page where it has a shop. You click on that, and you'll be able to buy Abbeville Institute apparel. Great embroidered t-shirts, hats, fleece, all kinds of great things. So go on out there and get your Abbeville Institute apparel. And, of course, don't forget that we exist on your generous contributions alone, so please consider a tax-deductible donation to the Abbeville Institute. You can do that at the top of our webpage as well. Just click on the button that says support, and you've got donation options, and you can find all that information there. You can donate monthly or annually. We do appreciate your support. So if you like this podcast, you like what we do, our articles and our conferences, please consider a tax-deductible donation to the Abbeville Institute. And last but not least, we have our conference coming up November 10th, 2018 in Dallas, Texas. So it's going to be on the topic of nullification and secession, a discussion of those two particular ideas and whether they would work in the 21st century or not. And in fact, that's what I'm going to be talking about most of the podcast today. So this is a great opportunity to mention that conference because we had a couple of articles that deal with that issue. And as you look at what's going on in the American polity right now, and you're looking at the Brett Kavanaugh Supreme Court confirmation hearings, and you see the fracturing of America, part of the problem has been, and will continue to be, this idea of one-size-fits-all government in America, top-down government, where 50 plus one can decide what the other 50 people do. And if you had 101 people, 51 people can decide what 50 people are going to do. And of course, that's going to create a tremendous amount of anxiety, anger, angst. And we have a very closely split, in many ways, American polity. Now, if you remove California from the equation, that changes a lot of things. When people talk about how there's millions of more people that support X, Y, or Z position or candidate, the issue comes down to California. And this is why we've talked about California secession on this podcast before, why we've written about it on our website. But the point is, in all of this, one size fits all, top-down government, an American nation, a national government, creates a difficult situation for Americans of both political spectrums, right or left. And the real solution has always been staring us right in the face, and that's real federalism. And so when the Abbeville Institute was established and founded in 2002, this is one of Dr. Livingston's pet projects, to discuss this idea of federalism, to discuss this idea of state solutions to problems that seem bigger than what a national government can do. Now, in order to make this work, you have to have a culture. You have to have something to defend. You have to have some type of people that are unified in a particular position. And years ago, the late Bill Cawthon wrote a piece for Southern Partisan magazine that talked about what an independent South would look like. And he brought up even, left-wing Southerners were more likely to vote for particular issues than left-wing Northerners because the South has a political culture. And this is something when I addressed Jimmy Carter a couple of weeks ago, people were very upset about me bringing up Jimmy Carter, but as Clyde Wilson has pointed out to me, Carter was no more left-wing than the Bushes. So we're willing to accept George W. Bush because he has R behind his name, but not Jimmy Carter because he has D. It's faulty logic. And I'll bring up Jimmy Carter again with the piece that we had on Wednesday. But certainly, when you look at the political culture of the South, or you look at the political culture of California, you look at the political culture of Massachusetts, or New England as a whole, those particular regions, I mean, do we want the entire United States governed by the political culture of one particular state or one particular region if you live outside of that region or that state? And I think the answer is conclusively no. Nobody wants that on the left. Nobody wants that on the right. So the real solution is the founder's design, which is originalism or federalism. And not just that. If those things don't work, there has to be some type of state check on unconstitutional federal power. This is the whole point of nullification. In fact, Calhoun said over and over again, nullification was there to help save the Union, not to break the Union apart. When you have state action that can block unconstitutional laws, you're saving the Union, because the other option is disunion. The other option is a state leaving the Union, and not just that. If that's not going to happen, then it's the exact thing that the founders worried about, which was coercion of a state. And you can find this over and over again in the ratification debates. In the North, in the South, there was open discussion about what would happen if the general government passed a law that was unconstitutional. Well, some of the founding generation said, well, the Supreme Court will take care of that. They'll declare it unconstitutional. Patrick Henry said in the Virginia Ratifying Convention, I hope that happens. But what happens if it doesn't? What happens if the Supreme Court doesn't take care of that? Then what do? Then what do the people of the states do at that point? If you have an clearly unconstitutional law passed by the Congress, the president signs it, the Supreme Court upholds it, then what do? And we see this all the time. We've had several laws that could fit the bill here. So then what do? What do the states do? What do the people of the states do to block those laws? Well, the only thing they can do is invoke the 10th Amendment and say, well, that power is not delegated to the general government and we're not going to follow it. And if you think this is lunacy, if you think this is somehow invented or has been invented in the 20th century or even the 19th century to protect racism or slavery, well, you're wrong. In fact, during the period leading up to American independence, the founding generation used nullification over and over again against unconstitutional British law. This was one of the hallmarks of the resistance to unconstitutional authority from George III. So this is why we're having a conference on this particular issue, because in the 21st century, we're starting to see this particular idea gain steam, and it's in a variety of issues, left-wing issues and right-wing issues. This is not ideological in that. It's not something that only the left supports or the right supports. This is something that all Americans could get behind and understand that we have a central authority. It doesn't matter who's in charge. It's going to pass unconstitutional legislation, and that's going to create, again, political unrest, because 50 plus one people, 50% plus one, can decide what the other, essentially 50%, are going to do. Well, that's not good government. We could call that, quote-unquote, democracy, because it is. But is that effective government? This is why the founding generation wanted to ensure that the states retained all powers not delegated to the central authority. And if you look at the powers delegated to the central authority, they're few and far between. Essentially, they cover two topics: commerce and defense. That's it. Go out and read Article 1, Section 8. There's not a whole lot there, and you can find if you look at Article 1, Section 8, and then you compare Article 1, Section 10 of the U.S. Constitution, Article 1, Section 10 denies the states certain powers. Those same powers are delegated to the central authority in Article 1, Section 8. Everything else is left to the states. And this is exactly how the founding generation sold the Constitution to the states when it was going through ratification. There's no question it would not have been ratified if anything else were true. James Wilson of Pennsylvania, the arch nationalist, the man who wanted to essentially abolish the states and worked throughout his political career to try to show that the states never really existed before the Continental Congress, which was lunacy. I called it 18th century fake news. He, in fact, drafted his own version of the Declaration of Independence. I mean, this is how crazy this guy was. James de Caledonia. James de Caledonia, a man who wanted to ensure that the Senate was popularly elected, who believed that the central authority should have an absolute negative over the states. This is the guy, the arch-nationalist, stood up at the State House Yard speech, which was issued. He gave this speech just a couple of weeks after the Constitution had been signed in Philadelphia. And he gave this speech in Philadelphia at the State House Yard, right at Independence Hall. And he says, look, when you look at this document, everything that is not expressly delegated, and he used the term expressly several times, everything that is not expressly delegated, whether it's this speech or other speeches, is reserved to the states, because the states have unlimited powers where the central authority only has the powers that we give it. And one of the arguments that's often given for, well, nullification is unconstitutional. Nothing in the Constitution says the states can nullify law. Nothing in the Constitution says the states can secede. Well, that's actually true. It doesn't, because it didn't have to. This was reserve power of the states. If it's not denied in Article 1, Section 10, the states can do it, and it's not denied in Article 1, Section 10. The states could do everything. This is how the Constitution was sold, that wasn't expressly denied in Article 1, Section 10, and the central government could only do what was granted in Article 1, Section 8, or throughout the rest of the document in other areas. And of course, people bring up the Supremacy Clause, which is only, the general government is only in supreme in pursuance of the Constitution, which means the powers that are delegated, or granted, as it said in Article 1, all legislative powers herein granted. Well, who's granting them? The states. So we could go on and on about this. This is why we're having a conference on this particular issue, and why Ronnie Kennedy wrote an article on Monday about this. Are nullification and secession real solutions to modern problems? Or are they just wacko, crazy, harebrained ideas? I think more and more Americans are waking up to the fact that, you know what, maybe the states, because the states have a tremendous amount of power, need to get involved and do something here. Now, there are problems with this. One of the more important is that the states slop at the trough just like individuals do, and they want the federal cash to do all of their legislative programs. I mean, state legislators have little understanding, as little understanding of the Constitution as those in Congress. So education really is an issue, and this is why the Abbeville Institute exists. And this is not subversive, this is not dissident, this is just looking at the federal design of the United States government. It's a federal republic. That's all we're talking about here. The original design of the United States. We're talking about the founding generation, those that drafted the Constitution and the Articles of Confederation and 13 state constitutions, and how they conceptualized the general government. The evidence is all out there. There were nationalists. There were those that wanted to abolish the states. There were those that wanted an absolute negative over state law. You know what? They lost. And the Constitution would not have been ratified had they won. They lost. They lost the argument in the founding period. But yet somehow we seem to forget that, because it's expedient not to do that. We want our guy in the general government. We want our iron-fisted man in the presidency to go up there and just take it to the other side. And that's all fine and dandy. It's fun. You know, if you're on the left and your guy's in power, you can take it to those on the right. If you're on the right and your guy's in power, you can take it to those guys on the left. But what does this do? It creates political unrest. It's going to create a nasty political situation, ultimately, if we don't come up with real solutions to these problems that are peaceful. And state action that reflects the political culture of the people in those states. For example, California could have its socialist utopia, and the rest of the people of the United States could care less. They just wouldn't worry about it at all. because it would only affect California. And if you don't like it, you can leave. You can leave California, and you can go live in a state that better reflects your political culture. This could happen. It is the most peaceful thing to do. But we don't look at it that way. For some reason, Americans think if it's happening in California, it's happening here in my state. It's not true. It's not true at all. Now, if we're tied into a system of government where California can determine what happens in our state, well, then that's a problem. And that only is a problem if we have one-size-fits-all, top-down national government. Otherwise, it's not a problem at all. This is why nullification and secession, ultimately, are solutions to our political problems in the United States. And I think Ronnie Kennedy is right on with this. And he brings up, of course, if this is part of the founder's design, it is. And then he brings up, you know, what's happened over time and do these things actually work? And so the piece is a nice little summary of what we're going to be talking about in Dallas from a multiple array of speakers. I mean, we have Dr. Livingston will be there, of course, talking about the history of these things and philosophy behind it. And then we have people like Michael Bolden, who is the head of the 10th Amendment Center, who's putting these ideas into practice, putting these solutions forward. And it's, again, it's not left or right. It's people, it's Americans saying, you know, we want to take our power back. As I say in my own podcast, if you don't listen to that, the Brian McClanahan Show, it's think locally, act locally. This is what we're doing. You're taking the power back in your own state. You're saying enough is enough. We're going to do this here. We're going to do it in our local community. We're doing this ourselves. There's nothing subversive about that. It's purely American. And so, the conference, I think, will be wonderful. And we had a piece this week that focused on that. Plus, we had a book review by Kevin Gutzman on Jefferson's constitutional thought. And the one thing, Dr. Gutzman wrote a book recently on Thomas Jefferson himself, and we've reviewed that book on this podcast and, of course, on our website. And one of the things that Kevin Gutzman continually points out in his work on Jefferson is that Jefferson was supremely dedicated to the principle of federalism. It drove his political career. If there's nothing else you take away from Jefferson politically, it was federalism. Now, we can look at Jefferson's time in the executive office, particularly his second term, as problematic. And Jefferson recognized that. But Jefferson was a reformer. I mean, Jefferson wanted to reform his home state of Virginia. He was interested in education reform, for example. He was interested in religious reform, but that only extended so far as Virginia. Because you see, what Virginia did was one thing, what Massachusetts did was another. And so his dedication to federalism was the most important thing to take away from Thomas Jefferson. That is the Jeffersonian belief. Plus, it is downgrading the executive office to a point where it's not an elected king. And this is what I talked about with Jimmy Carter. Whether it's image or not, I mean, people pointed out, well, you know, Jimmy Carter, his luggage was empty. Yes, I know that. But it's image. It's what Carter was trying to do there. It's Jeffersonian. You see, Americans believed in this principle in the antebellum period. When you look at the 1840 election, the propaganda behind that, it was a king, Martin Van Buren, versus the man of the people, William Henry Harrison. This is the propaganda that was used. Andrew Jackson, a man of the people. Now, of course, South Carolinians called him King Andrew. This is why the Whig Party was founded, because they thought the executive branch had too much power. Now, we can quibble with what the Whigs were trying to do politically, which was passing unconstitutional legislation in terms of the American system. But one of their main platforms was the presidency had too much power. It was unconstitutional what they were doing. So there was a complete reaction. A whole political party formed, in part because they believed the president had too much power. That's the American tradition. I mean, I think that Michael Holt has pointed out in his massive study on the Whigs, which is like 1,000 pages, this thing is huge, the American Whig Party, that Henry Clay was not a Federalist. He was a Jeffersonian Republican who had this nationalist strain in terms of economics, but when it came to government itself and what the government could do at time, particularly the executive branch, he was very Jeffersonian in that way. Now, when John Tyler was president, the two had a falling out. Tyler, as I've said before, is the greatest president in American history. But Clay's argument against Tyler was that he had too much power. The president had too much power. That was it. So when you look at this idea of nullification, secession, federalism is what we're talking about. That's Jefferson's main point over and over again, is that the general government only had specific powers granted to it or delegated to it, or as many people in the founding generation said, as they were arguing for ratification, expressly delegated to it. I mean, that term expressly was used. They didn't use it in the 10th Amendment because it was seen as redundant. Everyone understood what delegated meant. It meant the same as expressly delegated. I mean, using an adverb in front of something doesn't change the meaning of the term. It's like saying that's serious or very serious. Is there a difference? If something is serious, that's serious. I mean, I guess we could say that, you know, we've got...
I don't know what you mean by
it. I guess we could say that if something is gravely or very, it doesn't change the meaning. So those are two important pieces. And then when we get to the piece on Wednesday, it's by Michael Arnheim, and it's on voter ID. And as I mentioned before, political culture matters. And he's pointing out how the South has come up with some valid legal arguments for voter ID. And this is something that's important because, again, political culture in the South is in favor of voter identification. And it's not just right-wing Southerners. He points out that Jimmy Carter was in a coalition supportive of voter identification, and how states like Texas are leading the way in allowing all kinds of forms of identification to vote. You can go and get a simple state. You don't have to have a driver's license. There's all kinds of ways to get a state-issued ID for very little money to show this is who I am and I'm going to vote. I know when I go vote in Alabama, I have to show an ID. And it's interesting how this is supposedly some type of, you know, hardship on people. But as Texas has shown, it can be done. And this is a 10th Amendment issue. If you look at the original Constitution, there's nothing in the powers of the general government that allow it to interfere as much as it does in state elections. Because the Constitution is very clear that the requirements that are there for electing state legislators are the same as electing federal legislators. And the states determine all of that. So we've gotten to a point where we think, well, I mean, we can't, the general government has control over elections, but that's not the case. Of course, we do have several amendments to the Constitution that determine, have further requirements on the states not allowing or allowing certain people to vote. I mean, you can't discriminate on age, you can't on anything over 18, you can't discriminate based on sex, male or female, you can't discriminate on race. You can't do those three things. But outside of that, the states can do whatever they want. I mean, there's discussions of states having some type of civics test to be able to vote. I mean, there's all kinds of proposals out there to where you can say, well, these, you know, we should have some type of restriction. You should be able to have to show an ID to go vote. I mean, so this is all about political culture, and it really comes down to federalism again, as Arnheim points out. He's a barrister interested in the American legal system and the U.S. Constitution, and it's a nice piece, a nice summary of what's going on and why this is important. But not just that, it's about political culture and federalism. I mean, if Massachusetts wants to have anybody walk in, they can vote several times if they want to. I mean, that's one thing. Now, of course, we can see how that could affect the rest of the United States if we have a national government. But if we don't have that, it doesn't matter. You see, they can have all the voter fraud they want in their own state, and they have to live with it. Same thing in California. But in the South, or in the places that want this, even if it's in North Dakota, it's essential that we understand that this is real federalism. Real federalism. And so I think this is, if we could have any takeaway from the Abbeville Institute and what we do, for 16 years, we've been talking about these issues in conferences and articles. 16 years. Now, the website that you have probably enjoyed at this point, where you've come across this podcast, what we've done on social media, it's only been around for about 4 years in its current form. And we produced a lot of material, and it's all free on the website. And this podcast is free, and all the things, because our main goal is to educate and to get people to understand that the American Federal Republic, the American federal system, is a beautiful political system to handle dissent, to handle the rights of the minorities. It's there to protect the political culture of a people against a tyrannical majority. This is what Calhoun pointed out. This was his current concurrent majority. This is what he pointed out. Eventually, what you're going to get is a situation where you have two parties scrambling for power. He wrote this in his disquisition. Two parties scrambling for power, and they're going to talk about the Constitution when they're not in power. Once they get in power, they ignore it. This is what we've got in the federal city today. Doesn't matter which party's in power. Once they're in power, they forget about the Constitution quite a lot, in fact. Because we want them to go out and do something about certain things. And then the other side is, you know, cries about the Constitution. They really don't care about it. Once they're in power, they'll abuse it too. So if we understand that, if we understand the real solution is simply federalism, then all the whining, all the hand-wringing, all these things that go on wouldn't happen. Because you know what? General government can't do X, Y, or Z. And I think Dr. Livingston has talked about the Swiss Federation and all the ways that things that they can do to curtail the power of the central authority. I mean, there are other examples out there. And there's the original Federal Republic, the design of it, that has their examples. There are historic examples. There are contemporary examples of political institutions that allow for greater autonomy of the small is beautiful, that make things work. I mean, and it's not a left-right issue. It's simply an issue of federalism. And what do you really want from your central authority? Do we really want an elected king? Do we really want a general government that can legislate for us in all cases whatsoever? As Tom Paine said in the American crisis, do we really want that? If you're on the left, do you want a government dominated by the right that can do that? If you're on the right, do you want a government dominated on the left that can, by the left that can do that? Obviously not. We don't want that. So the real solution to all this is federalism. And there was a time when this particular idea, or the South itself, and the last two pieces of the week kind of focus on that. There was a time when Northerners and Southerners saw eye to eye on a lot of things, and federalism was one of those things. There was a time when New Yorkers cheered Dixie. And so if we understand that the South is not the oddball politically, that it always, that Jeffersonian vision was the dominant vision of America for 80 years. And even after that, you go into the late 19th century, the reason people don't focus on those presidents in the late 19th century is because they're quote-unquote do-nothing presidents. They were restrained on purpose. The reason that people bash Calvin Coolidge is because he was restrained. The reason people make fun of Jimmy Carter is because he carried his luggage. This is supposed to be a slap at the presidency. Good. Good. So what we need to think about in America is that restraint, that Jeffersonian restraint on government, that Jeffersonian belief in federalism and political culture, the meaning of that and how it matters. Those are the things to take away from the Southern tradition. What is true and valuable in the Southern tradition is what we do, and that is one of them. And of course, also discussing real Southern culture. And just in closing, we had the passing of a great Southern cultural icon, and that was Burt Reynolds. And I wrote about Burt Reynolds in February around his birthday. He's 82 years old, had a heart attack, and died. And there was a time in the 1970s when it was cool to be Southern, and Burt Reynolds certainly personified that. So we had a conference on Southern music. We should probably do one in the future on sometime on Southern art and include the visual arts, and that would include film and the theater and, of course, paintings. We should do that sometime. And Burt Reynolds was an individual who gave the South an image in the 1970s, helped do that. And so, you know, rest in peace, Gator McCluskey is up there now with Bama McCall. Bama McCall being Jerry Reed, these two guys that really were part of that 1970s Southern cultural revival, and now both are not with us. So that said, I hope you enjoyed this week in review at the Abbeville Institute. Until next time, good day.